And welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces. Daisy Maldonado and I are going to have the pleasure of talking with Joe Cervantes, State Senator Joe Cervantes, for the next hour. The first half hour alone with him, unless you call and join us at 526-5825 to ask a question or make a comment, which you're invited to do. And then the second half hour, we'll be talking with both Joe and Kathy Stark, and specifically about our doctor shortage, how it ought to be addressed, how it will be addressed, what we foresee for the new legislative session starts in January. So welcome, first of all.
Good morning. Good morning, Peter. Daisy, good morning.
Good morning.
And Daisy, you want to ask him about a hot issue in the county that in the area he represents?
Project Jupiter?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, and thanks, Peter, for starting there. Because I guess I want us to take us back, though, to September. You know, you had mentioned that you saw me in protesting and, you know, at the Water Resource Committee meeting and then at the Legislative Finance Committee meeting. Anyway, I feel like you had expressed maybe some skepticism about the project. And anyway, I guess I want to know now, like, given what we know now, you know, in particular about air quality permits and what we know about what the project is really doing, because there was a lot of, there wasn't a whole lot of information about the project. Yeah. And so, yeah, what are your thoughts about it? And
well, first of all, it is part of the county that I represent as a senator. And so it's important for me always to be looking for opportunities for jobs and economic development, diversification of our economy, all the things that are important. I can't help but note communities all around the country are turning down these large data centers for any number of different reasons. But I think the biggest concern for us is the focus on process. The process has been flawed, terribly flawed. The legislation that was passed was snuck in, as happens in Santa Fe from time to time. The county commission rushed this through without wanting any public attention or scrutiny. And what we really have learned since then is a couple of things. One is we've spent a lot of this administration. This was a Democrat administration after a Republican administration at Santa Fe. And we've spent a lot of the last couple of years really trying to get hold of climate change and carbon emissions and so forth. We passed the Energy Transition Act, groundbreaking environmental laws. We've just eviscerated all of it. We all of the grand goals and touting our accomplishments for environmental work. Essentially, now we passed a law that says this project is not subject to all of those environmental controls, number one. And number two, it will become the largest user of natural gas in the entire state of New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Take the oil and gas industry, anything you want to do, coal generation, power generation, anything you want to do, this will surpass any of that.
Equals what we're doing now.
Yeah, yeah, and we're essentially saying, we're going to give you an exemption to all of our environmental laws.
Right.
It kind of makes a mockery out of everything that's been done for the last 7 years, and we're already seeing that. Yeah. And I said that at the time we passed that ETA. I said, look, this is just aspirational, and we're already undoing it because of this project and others.
Any hope that we can do anything to stem it?
Well, Daisy's doing a little bit with it.
There are actually a couple of lawsuits, and of course there's a complaint about the Open Meetings Act, which I have, you know, I can't speak as a lawyer, which I used to be, because I haven't researched it as fully, but as a commentator, it sure looks to me as if they violated it.
Yeah, it looks that way to me, too. The problem with our open meetings law, of course, is that when a governmental body like the county here violates that law by doing things in private and secret, they can correct it by just going back and doing it again in public. And you know, that's I guess, reasonable, but it kind of still stinks.
They can, but to me, the fact that they're going to have to do it again, I mean, they ran this through as secretly as they could, basically. They had a couple of public things right at the last moment. But even the county commissioners, as Susie Shaparo notably claimed or complained, that even they didn't see the whole document, the whole deal when they voted. Now the public has had more time to look at it. The commissioners, is there any hope that maybe, yes, they can redo it? But what if they say, we're going to redo this, but we're going to require you to, you know, use 60% renewable energy for your gas-fired, for your electricity plant. I mean, so theoretically, they could do that. I don't know.
Yeah, they could. I mean, this is a very complicated area. It's a complicated development. The energy, they're leaving themselves open to nuclear power generation. Yep. They're going to use massive amounts of power. That's what these data centers require. They're saying they're not going to use much water. I really don't believe that. But in any event, yeah, the county could come in and put a lot of restrictions and limitations. It's very clear they're not going to do that. This county commission has decided, come hell or high water, they're going to green light this project. The better question for me is why? You know, who's driving this train? And why are they so essentially adverse to slowing things down, taking a good, thorough look, and really doing public vetting? They don't want to do that. And I don't know why. That doesn't make sense.
I think staff is definitely a factor in that. But the commissioners, the buck stops with them. Got to say, it's interesting that it'll affect things, that Shannon Reynolds has resigned, and so we'll have the governor appointing a new commissioner between now and whenever they have to redo this, if they are told by the AG that they or a court that they have to redo it. Mm-hmm. And she'll pick somebody probably who is in love with the project. I think it's – I mean, some people have asked me, you know, are they getting money? I don't think so. I don't think they're being bribed or whatever, but I think they have a pretty misguided idea of what's good for the county. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't have any reason to think there's financial corruption involved here, too. I just think they're out of their depth. And that's not to be disparaging. This is incredibly complicated, incredibly billions of dollars. You're talking about a $165 billion project. Let me just tell you, the entire state budget, all of our public education, universities, law enforcement, corrections, you name everything we do, is about $11 billion. Right. So our entire state runs on $11 billion. This is $165 billion.
And I think that fact was a wow to the county manager and some of the commissioners. Well, we're going to get something that big here in our little county. Yo, guys, it may not be, you know, an elephant sits on you. That's big, too.
Yeah, and I'll just throw in, Peter, I mean, this is not being driven by the county commission. It's not being driven by the county staff. This is coming out of Santa Fe. Let's just be very blunt about it. I mean, the legislation to authorize and get the ball rolling here began in Santa Fe back in February and March. It was done just like here in the dark of the night at the last minute without any oversight. And so this is being driven out of Santa Fe. And we had to find out.
I also think before we get to that point that the county, you say they were out of their depth. Well, you and I as lawyers know a lot of stuff gets negotiated, and a lot of stuff happens because some people one side has a sophisticated team of lawyers and experts on its side, and the other one doesn't, and there's a lot of stuff that looks innocent. Well, we didn't have a county lawyer, and then we did have one who did not have, you know, and I don't mean to criticize her, that she did not have the kind of experience that this would have required. And I don't know that they had a real expert on their side either. So I'm concerned. But I think you might be right that the real impetus comes from Santa Fe. What do we do about that?
No doubt. There's no doubt. Yeah. There should be no doubt, number one. Number two, Peter, you mentioned you and I are both lawyers, have been practicing. If somebody comes to me and asks me to do a will for them, a simple document, I'm not going to do it because I don't do wills. I know where to stay in my lane of practice. And I think you're right. County. There's no way the county could have the staff, the resources, the expertise.
Isn't there also one of the people who's involved in this on the company's side? Isn't she a
yes?
Yeah, two, not one, two.
Two who are we didn't finish my sentence because I babbled too much. But yeah, pals and former associates of the governor.
Well, they're former cabinet secretary. Mm-hmm. So you have the former cabinet secretary of economic development. And again, I have a lot of respect for her. She did a great job in that capacity. But she left the government to go into the private sector to spearhead this project. Mm-hmm. And again, we see that revolving door all the time in government, where people manage to take their learning and expertise and connections and then turn it into a very lucrative sideline after government.
And it's legal. It would have a huge impact if the governor were running for re-election, which, of course, she can't. I think. I mean, I think it'd be.
I used to think a president could only serve two terms. Yeah. We live in strange times. I mean,
TBD.
Yes.
Yeah.
Could I actually? So, with this project as well, right? When you're talking about, it's not going to use that much water, right? Or that's what they claim, and you don't believe it. However, the rumors and what we're hearing too, just about the water concerns, right, in our area, and we owe water to Texas, and what are we going to do about that? What are your thoughts about sort of this coming year and our community having access to surface water, and then just how much you know, we're going to lose through pumping, you know, during the irrigation season, that's not going to get recharged?
Well, there's a lot in your question, Daisy, so let me start. I mean, water has always been a very particular interest and subject that I've tried to develop some expertise on in the legislature. So just like my law practice, I focus and specialize on certain things, the same thing in the Capitol, and water is one of them. There'll be a lot of talk about this grand settlement between Texas and New Mexico in the longstanding lawsuit, and I'm very concerned about that agreement. Because I think that really all it does is it transfers the fight between New Mexico and Texas to New Mexico versus New Mexico. In other words, the agreement is we're going to deliver all this water to Texas. That means the North shipping it down to us. And realize down here in southern New Mexico, we're metered, we're in court, we're adjudicating and so forth. Once you get above up in the middle ground, they're not even adjudicating. They don't even try to figure out who's using what water because they don't want to know. And so to get them to put more of the water down here and send it down to the reservoir, which is really what should be happening, is not what's going to happen. So the plan right now is to fallow a very substantial part of this valley. And that is a great concern of mine, to think that we're going to be driving around in this beautiful community of ours in the Missouri Valley and just seeing abandoned dry farms. And that's the plan, is to fallow a good part of the farmland down here. And I disagree with that.
Well, so why wouldn't anyway, what's going to happen, you know, or not happen up north? Why wouldn't that happen in terms of measuring I would assume there's some, like, legal mechanisms, right, that can be used
I think there will be, yeah. Okay. And that's why I said the fight, we're changing the
fight. Why doesn't somebody talk to the state legislature about making a law they got to measure their water?
Well, that's why I said we're going to change the fight between Texas versus New Mexico. And I think New Mexico, we were told in the legislature for a decade we were going to win this lawsuit, that we were in the right, that Texas was wrong. We kept pumping millions and millions of dollars into that fight. And when the court finally said, okay, we're going to have a trial, as is typical, that everybody folded, right? And so New Mexico folded and agreed to a lot of things. And Texas is a pretty formidable adversary, well-funded, big politically and so forth. So we gave in
and
to
didn't
Texas.
Didn't the U.S. also take a position?
They did. That the U.S. took a position that favored us down here in the South. In other words, the U.S. sided up with Elephant Butte Irrigation, the Reclamation District, because they essentially said, look, Elephant Butte Reservoir was built by the federal government. All of the canals and drainage systems we have were built by the federal government. They have been paid for by the farmers. The farmers have been assessed over decades the costs of that project. So the farmers down here said, hey, we've got the right to control that system, and the feds agreed. And the feds said, we're going to side with the farmers down here against Texas and against, frankly, northern New Mexico. But in the end, there's a settlement in place. Again, I think what the settlement's going to mean is the legislature appropriating maybe $100 million to go essentially fallow farms down here. And there are other solutions that are better solutions.
Indeed.
They stumped you.
We ought to move on to general legislative concerns. Of course, this session that's coming up is the 30-day short session, primarily budget matters. We'll get into the medical malpractice and doctor shortage issue in a bit. What are you seeing as the most contested issues?
you're right, first
aside
of all.
Aside from that.
You're right to, first of all, remind all of us that it's a 30-day session, which means that we're limited largely to budget matters, although legislators are very creative about getting around that limitation, and number one. Number two, we're also subject to the issues the governor wants to make relevant and germane to the session. It should be interesting because this will be her last session after what will be 8 years in office. And so I expect the governor, who's a very ambitious, driven individual, to try and get things done here at the end that she hasn't been able to do in prior years. So I expect a strong push. I hope the emphasis will remain on crime, which I think is a very legitimate concern for everyone statewide. And those of us here in Las Cruces in particular, we've seen crime really take off down here, and that's sad.
You mentioned her being ambitious. Any speculation on what she might do in the future, if anything, politically?
There's a lot of speculation about that. the governor is, as I said, very driven, has a tremendous amount of energy.
Yes.
She's young, and I have a very hard time thinking she's going to find a rocking chair and hang out at Cracker Barrel. I just don't see that in her near future. So she'll be doing something, I'm sure, exciting.
Well, that's good. I guess I will ask you one question that's related to the doctor shortage. She has put on the she's put on the calendar for you guys to consider medical malpractice, which obviously includes some steps that could be taken to stem the doctor shortage. But when I look at it, an objective study would say there are a hell of a lot more reasons for the doctor shortage than medical malpractice. Would it? So I guess my question is to you as a legislator, it's twofold. First, can you assume that medical malpractice refers to the larger problem and take steps such as the changing the GRT? Rule that the GRT applies to medical things, which it shouldn't, doesn't in any other states except Hawaii and us. Could you guys legislate on that, saying, well, that covers that, that's related, medical malpractice means this, or could she, and should we be telling her, expand your call, say not medical malpractice is on, but stemming the doctor shortage is on. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense, sure. And I like the way you're phrasing this because I think that's important in our dialogue. And I would tweak it just a little bit to say the issue really is accessibility to health care. That really is the issue. And we all have that experience. I have a hard time getting in to see a doctor just the same as everybody else in this community does and around the state.
I don't want to argue it too detailed, but, I mean, could we do something? You know, what's the answer to practically what we should do?
There are some real obvious answers to that. So any of us, I don't have an MBA. I don't think I need an MBA. The old lesson, I'm a businessman from a lifetime, it's about supply and demand. If you have much more demand than you have supply, you have to increase your supply. And we, believe it or not, for all of the – we see all these new hospitals being built, Presbyterian, huge towers, adding beds, huge facilities, technologies. We haven't added graduates to our medical school at UNM in decades. We still graduate the same number of doctors despite all of the need for care.
I don't want to get into arguing the details till Kathy's here.
But, okay, sure.
You know, because, yeah, I think that one of the additional – aspects of this that maybe as important, at least, as the malpractice issues, is the fact that we don't have residency slots here.
Exactly right.
Whether you guys can do anything about it is another question. But I guess my question is, procedurally, should we be asking her loudly to expand her description of the call of what she's adding, from medical malpractice to doctor shortage, or can you guys get around that and legislate something and then she's faced with either passing it or vetoing it?
No, I'd like to think we're going to be more constructive than that. Remember that a lot of the criticism in the last few years has been about a bill that was passed in 2021. It was House Bill 75. That's the reason you're hearing so much about medical malpractice right now, because there's a huge trigger date in that bill that was passed in 2021. The hospitals are taken out of what's called the patient compensation fund at the end of this next year, and they're panicking. This next session is their last chance to fix that. And realize the taxpayers, you all out there in taxpayer land, have funded this fund that's actually what is used to pay medical malpractice claims. We funded it by $100 million in the last 3 years. So doctors are being told that the reason they're paying more for insurance and the reason that they can't be paid better salaries, or the hospitals and the insurance industry use those as excuses. But the reality is the taxpayers have been paying most of these claims from general fund appropriations, $100 million. That's all going to end under the compromise from 2021. Now, what's important about that compromise in 2021 is the governor led that negotiation between the hospitals and the doctors, and they reached this agreement to do it this way. But the hospitals and the doctors, mostly the hospitals really, and the insurance industry are now wanting to change that deal.
Yeah. So they want it to go back to, or essentially amend it so that taxpayers continue to pay into that fund as opposed to hospitals.
I think that's right, Daisy. I mean, I'm trying to be very good and met last week, for example, with the CEO of the hospital in Santa Fe. I'm trying to listen to the industry and hospital executives about what they want. So I don't want to say what they want. I will tell you that they made a deal in 2021. Now, when you talk to them, they'll say that they were forced into the deal by the governor and, and by the leadership. But remember that you're hearing that this was led by the trial lawyers. That's completely false. I had nothing to do with that bill, and I've had nothing to do with any of the legislation at all. This was a compromise between the governor and the hospitals and the leadership of both Democrat and Republican leadership in the Senate, which did not include the trial lawyers. Now, there were trial lawyers represented at that negotiation, of course, but it didn't include me. So everybody out there who thinks that I'm the guy who's calling all the shots and pulling all the strings here, sorry to disappoint you, but no, I wasn't at the table for that one. But there is a pressure right now to do something. And I think because the governor led the last settlement and negotiation, I think she'll be open to trying to do that again here maybe in her last year.
Switching topics.
Yeah.
And I know this is longer term and maybe not something you'll deal with in this session. And we've talked about it a bit, but it ain't going away. How can we do better at harmonizing the need to protect individual rights and the need to protect people from folks who hurt them but are not able to be tried because their minds have gone south. Notably, we had a long-term criminal put in the hands of the FBI, which is somewhat controversial and concerning. You can comment on that if you want, but that problem. How are we going to improve things?
Yeah, let me try and understand your question in more simple terms for me, Peter, which is I think you're talking about competency, right, and the revolving door of people who are arrested by our police and then taken to court and then immediately released because they're deemed by the judges to be incompetent. I'm as frustrated as anyone. I have a good dialogue going with Las Cruces Chief of Police Story, and we discuss these issues. We need to do a better job of not letting people game the process. That's really what a lot of this is. We make it very easy for people to go in and claim lack of competency. We have a new district attorney who's been on the job a year. I think he's trying to turn things around there and do a much more diligent job. He's, I think, doubled or tripled the number of attorneys he has prosecuting cases. And we've got to really reevaluate the way that we keep and select judges. Because I'm concerned that judges have perhaps lost touch with the community desires for safety, public safety, and so forth. And between the judges and the evaluations for competency, I think they're very quick to say, you're not competent, and we're going to catch you loose and see you tomorrow.
And we should note that the individual, Garcia, who was put in the hands of the FBI, which concerned a lot of people because the FBI is a suspect organization these days because of its upper management, and they are doing some unfortunate things. At any rate, that individual had been, the lawyers had tried to impose the kind of program that we've put in place, where that person could be treated or at least sent up to Las Vegas to be checked out for competency, but, you know, do something to help them. And the judge refused to push that.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if I want to quite begin to attack the FBI overall for their leadership in Washington D.C. these days. But what I would like to say, Peter, if I can interrupt you, is just to make sure that
I interrupted you.
We don't want to be the place where we have to go to the feds to do the job that we're not doing as a state.
Right.
And that's what's going on. We're saying, we can't handle this, so we're going to go to the feds, and they'll take care of this. And we should be able to take care of our
own. Let me be clear, and I've said this, I think, in a column, but I think the local people from the FBI are normal law enforcement folks trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
I think, though, that the ICE is doing some terrible things.
Different story, different subject.
The FBI is certainly in Washington doing some things that are a little questionable.
Sure.
Under current leaders. Their leader is a disaster. And down the road, even if in this case it's justified, down the road it's a concern because, and I'm not – I have a dialogue with Chief Story too. But down the road, he could not like Daisy or me for saying the wrong thing, or Lucas Herndon for criticizing him, and we get busted on some bogus charge by the FBI and taken a place that doesn't release us because Mr. Trump doesn't want us released.
Yeah.
So it's a legitimate concern, but I agree with you. We ought to be able to, and I've said so, take care of our business better. This is Speak Up Las Cruces. Daisy Maldonado, myself, Peter Goodman, are having the pleasure of talking with Senator Joe Cervantes, State Senator Joe Cervantes. And we're going to take a very short break and then be joined by Kathy Stark to discuss the shortage of doctors and the fact doctors are leaving the state and what role malpractice insurance plays in that, what are the factors, and what can the state do to stem the flow? And welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces. The topic is doctor shortage and what New Mexico can do about it. It's a national problem, but we have it worse. I'll say that I'm kind of in the middle. I don't like some of what the trial lawyers have done in terms of obfuscating some things, and I think breaking the law until they were told otherwise by the ethics folks about identifying their contributors who turn out to be largely trial lawyers. On the other hand, reducing punitive damages has always been a right-wing cause. I think a lot of the people who are criticizing the trial lawyers make it about malpractice, and malpractice is one of five or six major factors. It's probably not the chief one. Having said that, let me ask you each, starting with Kathy, in a minute or so, tell us what should the legislature do this January about the doctor shortage?
30-day session, that's tough.
Well, it's on the call, so forget about the limitations and just assume that you were a legislator committed to doing the best you could, and forget about what the nature of the call, and it's supposed to be mostly financial.
Well, I was listening to you earlier, Peter, and you said that the advocates' focus has been on MedMal, and in part I agree because the doctors have told us this is a huge burden for them. But from our perspective, it's much broader than that. I mean, we have the GRT. We don't have enough residency slots. And so I could say residency, but it can take 7 years to get that through so that we actually have practicing providers. And so when I look at it, MedMal is up there towards the top, but I don't think it's doable in a 30-day session. I think it's more complex than that. GRT, I don't know that that's even feasible with the amount of money that it's brought in with medical services. The compacts, in my opinion, go right up towards the top. Then you've got the whole federal mess on, the H-1 B visas and the cost and who can pay for that. Is that something the hospitals will pay for? Is that something the state would pay for in order to increase the number? So it's not simple.
Well, Dr. Williams says tax, you know, make up the money by taxing the sodas that are making people obese and giving them diabetes. Joe?
Well, we need new doctors and more doctors now. I mean, we need this. We can't wait 5 years and 10 years. A lot of the so-called tort reformers that are out there talking about, well, let's limit the attorney's fees that the plaintiffs can have. Well, they don't want to limit the fees that defense lawyers can have. They want to go into the game completely with a one-sided approach. It's never going to happen. I mean, we're not going to do those things. What will work? What will work is a recognition that we need a lot more doctors. We need them now. I appreciate your point. And I'll just tell you, my daughter and new son-in-law are graduates of UNM Medical School. Mm-hmm. They had to do residencies. They went to Houston to do the best. They've had a hard time coming back, and it has nothing to do with medical malpractice. It has to do with residencies and fellowships and opportunities here. And they know, and I'm going to push back with you, Peter. I really hope we leave with one message. You said this earlier. It's worse here than anywhere. That's the message that's been out there, that we're losing more doctors than anywhere else. That's just false. That we have fewer doctors per capita than other states, that's false. The fact that so much of the narrative.
I'll research it.
I'll be happy to show you. I brought it with me.
It does seem as if the problem, and part of the problems are rural and not.
Very much. Mm-hmm. Very much.
Yeah, you know, and we're pretty damn rural. But what you said about your daughter and son-in-law brings up one key issue that I think we want to get your thoughts on, and that's the compacts. 40 plus out of 50 states or thereabouts are in medical compacts that allow doctors to move and other medical personnel more easily from place to place, whereas doctors in some states maybe don't want the competition the way lawyers have been about lawyers moving in from another state. Should we be joining those compacts? If not, why not?
So you're talking about compacts in plural, so there are multiple different compacts. The principal one in front of us is the medical compacts, and I think we're going to pass that very quickly in this next session. Now, again, I've been blamed as the obstacle to that. Let me disabuse everybody to that notion. I had two hearings on that as chair of the Judiciary Committee this last session. We passed that bill at a Senate Judiciary Committee with me as the chair, and we just had a hearing on it again this interim on the Courts Corrections Committee. So I have heard this bill repeatedly. We have passed it, and I've not been an obstacle to that at all. Now, let me be honest with you. It's probably going to have a negligible difference at all, because years ago, we in New Mexico, leading, passed a law to expedite licensing in the state of New Mexico. So you can already get an expedited license here very quickly from another state. We already have this in place here. We did this years ago without the compacts. We did it on our own. The difficulty is, frankly, the medical board still has the ultimate authority, and they haven't been using that law. So I don't think we're going to see an influx of doctors if we pass the compact. What we will perhaps improve on is telemedicine and the use of telehealth. Although I've got to tell you, we already do it, and I've been doing that for years. I get doctor medical care using telemedicine.
Yeah, I see a doctor in Alamogordo sometimes. We have you're going to need a headphone. Because we have a caller.
Just mine.
If you can't hear the caller on your headphone, tell me. Good morning.
Good morning.
And what do you want to say or ask?
Caller?
Guess that was a scary question.
It was a scary question.
Yeah. And Peter, well, if I can, I mean, I know there's not a question. I don't want to over-dominate the conversation. But the Hippocratic Oath for doctors is first do no harm. And I think we've done tremendous harm in the last year or 2 years telling doctors this is the place to leave, that you have more malpractice lawsuits here than any other state. That's completely false. Pick up your phone and do your chat GPT or run your AI research. You can do it however you want to do it. But if you look at the number of medical malpractice lawsuits per capita, which means adjusted for population, using the current data, New Mexico ranks about 23rd. Now, if you're listening to the narrative and the politics, we're number one, and that's just false. And if you look at the shortage of doctors, we don't have the shortage that Arizona does. And Arizona has no caps on medical.
Let me ask you about a couple of specifics. Apology laws. You know, you have a representative, Anaya, I think, has a committee she meets with of doctors and lawyers, and they talk like civil you know, community members about this kind of thing. And one of the issues that other states, most other states, I think, allow this is you can, if something goes wrong, I can say, Joe, I told you at the beginning 5% of people have this complication. I'm sorry that we couldn't prevent it in your case. That should not be used against me in a trial. Can we have an apology law that basically says you can't use a doctor's apology against him or her in court? And
sure.
If not, why not?
Sure. Okay. No, we absolutely can do that. Peter, you know this as a lawyer. That's already the law in terms of settlement negotiations. In other words, in the context of settling a matter, whatever is said in settlement negotiations is not admissible.
Right, but I'm talking about before you even get to a lawsuit, because one of the key things is that patients feel unheard. And if you're their doctor and you feel like, oh, I can't say, Kathy, I'm really sorry that didn't work out, we did our best, or whatever it is, if you feel like you can't say that, she feels like you don't give a shit.
No, we want to do that. Let me just, again, I'm trying really hard to solve our problem, which is how do we get doctors to come here? How do we get doctors to stay here?
Right.
And one of the ways is for us to point out all of the great stuff we do for doctors that is unique to New Mexico. So, for example, in New Mexico, our law for many years, the medical malpractice law, requires that before you can even bring a medical malpractice lawsuit, there has to be a panel hearing. And there has to be a meeting with doctors on a panel and lawyers on that panel. And they have to review the case before you can even file the lawsuit. And that's the opportunity to hear one side out and to have this panel of doctors saying, yeah, you plaintiff should go home. This is not a malpractice case. So we do that.
But they can opt out of doing that. When I looked at the statute, they can opt out of doing that. And the other quandary that I have with the Medical Review Commission is, so you have a panel, you've got attorneys there, you have physicians there, and then you have this other party, and they will look at the facts of the case and they will say it does not have merit.
Right.
Now, I understand that a person always has the right to access the court system.
Right.
That is their constitutional right.
Right.
We'll get with the caller in just a moment. Okay. I think the caller is a doctor whose time is limited.
So I do want to come back to this panel process.
Hello.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me on. And Mr. Goodman, I know you had invited me. This is Arthur Berkson. Walking to work, so I'm a little out of breath. Just a couple of quick points. First of all, I want to thank publicly Senator Carrie Hamblin, who had us talk to her Tax and Revenue Committee a couple days ago. Four of our doctors took off work, to go in there and speak to her committee. And they're very open to all the changes that are keeping doctors out. I'd like to say, one, that with all due respect, listening to two attorneys talk about why doctors are leaving is like listening to two white men talk about systemic racism and why it doesn't exist.
Thank you.
I talk to all my colleagues every day. I've talked to cardiologists, talked to primary care doctors about why they leave. And there are many reasons. But first and foremost are the extremist malpractice policies in New Mexico. There's no denying that. It is just universal across doctors who are private, doctors who are employed, doctors who are working for community health associations. So I appreciate the chance to be able to speak for doctors by doctors. I'm also the president of the Doñana County Medical Association, and I think there's confluence on that issue. And so talking about why doctors are leaving without bringing medical malpractice first and foremost is like talking about why houses disappeared in Ruidoso without talking about climate change and fires.
Dr. Berkson,
one more point, because I have to go pretty soon.
Okay.
The second point is expanding residency positions in New Mexico is incredibly important. Expanding medical school positions in New Mexico is incredibly important. But when I talk to friends and colleagues across the country, New Mexico has a known reputation for horrible medical malpractice where trial attorneys are very powerful positions in our state Senate and legislature. And so everybody knows what's going on. When laws were being passed in 2021, one of my GI colleagues was showing me texts from recruiters saying, we know what's going on in New Mexico, come practice in our state. And so it's frankly offensive to not put that at the forefront. And when creating residencies and medical school slots, if we don't reform medical malpractice, we're not going to have doctors to train doctors. So you can't just magically say
Let's accept what you're saying, that it is highly important. I'd like, and if you can stay with us for a moment, you could have some input on this. But in terms of malpractice, we were just talking about these committees that look at a lawsuit that gets filed and say, and I know a doctor who was sued. It's a bogus lawsuit. And the committee said 6-0. Doctors and lawyers all said this is bogus lawsuit, and it's been pursued for whatever reasons, you know, combination of the family's grief and the lawyers. Well, I won't get into it, but those things, what I think Kathy was going to point out, those committees don't have teeth. In California, we had a law, I don't remember if it's here in New Mexico too, that if you get a settlement offer. If I'm suing Kathy, and she says, "Look, I don't think I owe you anything, but you want $100,000, I'll pay you $10,000 just to get out of this," and she does it as a 30-06 offer or whatever it was, the statute. If I don't take that offer, and I then go to trial, if I don't do better than the $10,000 she offered, I got to pay the attorney fees she spent after that offer. I think we should change, or I want to throw out as a possibility, changing the law so that when that committee comes out 6-0 that your suit is nonsense, if you persist in it, the lawyer is going to have to pay the other lawyer's fees if you don't do better, if you don't win it.
Amen. 100%.
Well, there are states that do that. With MedMal.
I want to ask Joe what he thinks about it.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's an hour-long conversation. Yeah. Let me do, first of all.
An hour-long conversation. That's a very quick conversation.
This is the problem.
If the committee rules 6-0 that it's an egregious case, then should be the end of it.
Dr. Berkson, I just said that. I want to. We have very limited time here.
Amen.
I know your time is limited. I want
to
hear.
I think the most important thing is for me to tell Dr. Berkson what I've been telling any doctor who will listen to me, which is I'd love to meet with you.
Francis Williams has been trying to set up a meeting with us for 2 months.
All right, I'll try to set one up.
I love it. And I have set meetings, and they've been canceled by the doctors.
I'll take you both to lunch.
Never. But that is a straight-up misinformation.
All right, can we go towards a solution?
Ask Francis.
The suggestion I made.
Get her on the phone.
The suggestion I made, Joe.
Yeah.
A couple of sentences on why that's great, why it's
Peter. You'll remember from law school. We have what we call in the United States the American rule when it comes to legal fees, not the English rule, and that's why it would take an hour to describe what that means. Although I will tell you, we had a hearing on this in
that
my committee.
That part's very simple. In Britain, if you sue or defend a lawsuit and you lose, you pay the other side's attorney fees.
Right.
In the U.S., you don't unless by contract or statute.
Right.
Attorney. Okay, so that's easy. I'm asking you a practical question without getting back to law school.
Yeah, and the reason we don't have the English rule here is because that rule was designed to prevent you from suing the king, right? In other words, it meant the little guy couldn't take on the big guy. And here's the problem is that if you make a patient have to pay legal fees of a hospital, let's say the local hospital here is owned by LifePoint. LifePoint Health, Inc. is an $11 billion private equity company. An average person like you and Peter cannot take on an $11 billion corporation.
So we're not saying you do that when you file a lawsuit and you lose. We're saying if six people, including trial lawyers, say this is bogus and you persist, and I'm also suggesting, you may not like it, that the lawyers be on the hook for it, not the patient. Not necessarily. I mean, obviously the patient would have to be some plaintiff. Client would have to be somewhat, or there might be
problems between them. But I'm saying when the Medical Review Commission comes out that unanimously, you shouldn't pursue it unless you're so committed to it. I mean, lawyers, as you know and do, take on cases all the time where payment to them is not guaranteed.
Right.
You know, they take on contingency cases.
Right.
Whatever it may be, IPR cases. And maybe they get paid, maybe they don't. Well, add to that gamble that once the Medical Review Commission says unanimously this is nonsense, go home unless you're so sure that you'll bet paying somebody else's lawyer fees.
Yeah. The reason I bring up this entire process is to point out the fact that we in New Mexico do a lot of things to protect doctors. And I'm glad, as a father of a daughter who's a doctor, surgeon, and a father of a son-in-law who's a surgeon, I'm glad we do that. So in New Mexico, you can't just file the lawsuit. You've got to go through this panel process. Other states don't have this, right? So we do that to protect doctors.
And if the panel says this sucks, you can't sue the lawsuit?
No. You can always still pursue that. And I think that's the point Kathy was making.
What's the point?
There's no teeth. Well, the point of it is you were talking about an apology law. And the point of that is to have a plaintiff and a plaintiff's lawyer have a panel tell them, hey, you don't have a case here. And to have doctors review this carefully with lawyers together, and that little group meets and says and reviews it objectively and says, you don't have a case.
Guys,
let's agree.
Guys, I got to go.
Yeah.
Guys, I really got to go. I have patients waiting.
Love to meet with you, doctor.
I just want to make Joseph. It's Senator Cervantes.
Joseph's
Francis
good.
Francis, and he called me Arthur. Francis has given me multiple dates. I've given her multiple dates, and every time it hasn't worked out for some reason. I haven't canceled one meeting with you. Dr. Jean-Pierre Reinhold gave you his card.
I don't want to argue.
One second.
Dr. Berkson, no, I don't want to argue this on radio.
This is the main point I want to make, is that physicians, our whole mission in life is taking care of patients and making patients healthier. What we want in Las Cruces right now, we have one neurologist. I can't get my patients into a neurologist, can't get them into a neurosurgeon, can't get them into a rheumatologist. 20 years ago when I came back here, because I grew up here, graduated from Oñate High School, it was much easier. And now my colleagues are fleeing, and we can't convince people to come. And so our whole point is patient access. It's not our pocketbook. It's not maximizing our profits. We're not the giant hospitals. It's about patients being seen and patients being cared for.
And
thank you guys for the time. I really
appreciate
it.
Trying to help you do that, do email me, and I'll try to put you and Joe together.
Yeah, I'd love to do it.
We'll all have lunch.
I would love that. I would love to have our Doñana County Medical Society meet with him. It would be fantastic.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. And Francis had scheduled those with me before.
We'll do it.
Now, if I can, the critical thing that I hope we leave with this message with one thing out there, which is the doctors are justifiably concerned about all these things they're hearing.
Everybody's justifiably concerned.
They're not based on data and facts. Yeah. So if you look at the actual data, we don't have more lawsuits than other states per capita. We're about the middle of the states. We don't have this exodus that doctors are told is happening.
Move on to another suggested solution. We all know from watching TV that the standard of proof in a criminal case is beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the standard in all cases in Colorado, I learned last night researching. Amazing.
What's their burden of proof in Colorado?
let me is beyond a reasonable doubt. But there also, of course, in a civil case, is preponderance of the evidence. And that, as a trial lawyer, Joe said this to countless juries, preponderance just means if there's a ton of evidence on each side of the evidence scale and a feather drops on one, you got to find for that one. And then there are standards of proof in between, such as clear and convincing evidence, that are not as rigorous as the one for putting somebody in jail or executing somebody, but they're more rigorous than deciding whether or not you cut down a tree the neighbor wants you to cut down. A lot of states, for punitive damages, have clear and convincing evidence as a standard. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard in Colorado for that, and I think is too high. But it is clear and convincing evidence. How do you feel about that?
We may be open to that dialogue, Peter. Well, I will tell you, though, that what you're going to do is you're going to confuse what is already the standard for punitive damages. We already have law for – we already have a heightened standard for punitive damages in New Mexico. In other words, to get punitive damages, you have to prove willful, wanton, reckless conduct. That's in our law already. That's a very heightened standard, and we have definitions for what that means. We have a definition for what is reckless and willful and wanton. Mm-hmm. So if you add another standard in there – and you have to define that with cases, you may just make a bigger mess out of things. But I another important message I want to get out there is that doctors are concerned, understandably, that they could lose their wealth and their assets by a punitive damages award. And they're afraid, justifiably and understandably, because that's what they've been told. I've yet to find a single case, and I challenge anybody listening to give me a single case, where any doctor has ever been subject to punitive damages where there's been a collection against personal assets of a doctor. I don't think it's ever happened, but doctors are persuaded that in New Mexico that can happen, and it scares them away, and I can understand why.
Well, let me build on that if I could.
Sure.
You should see my dining room table. I've got hearing slides and research slides and whatever. So when you talk about punitive damages, and what I heard over and over and I think it was the CC&J committee meeting, was they don't happen. One person said, I know of one. I believe you said it's not going to happen. If that's the case, what is the problem with capping them and having clear and convincing? That takes the worry off of doctors and their families. I mean, we had a doctor here, much like Peter said, went through the MRC, was found not to have merit, proceeded to court, prevailed at court, but the trauma on that individual and his family was immense. And years later, I was at a meeting, and she was still talking about how traumatizing that is. So if it doesn't happen, why not cap it? And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you get sued for malpractice, punitive damages are out there, but the standard is clear and convincing.
No, that's just not
that's
correct.
That's not, so okay.
You and I need to talk more.
Yeah, well, I want 2 hours
we'll
with you.
That no,
that's right, we have to do it. So,
I don't see Fishman yet, so maybe we'll be able to go over a little bit.
No, but you make a good point. In other words, as a lawyer, and I do medical malpractice cases, if I botch it, I can be sued for malpractice, and I can be sued for punitive damages, and there's no cap on my punitive damages either. And importantly, there – I should back up. There is always a cap on punitive damages. There are a number of caps on punitive damages, starting with the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court in the BMW case said that punitive damages cannot be greater than a multiple of the compensatory damages. So if the award is $100, punitive damages maximum can only be 10 times that. Punitive damages are also always capped by a judge. A judge can always remit damages. I will just tell you that I tried a case back in May, a terrible, tragic case here at the local hospital. Baby's skull was crushed, broken, brain damaged. Baby died in childbirth. The jury deliberated for days, including on a Friday night till almost midnight. They came back with an award of $15.5 million for that baby's death and the parents. And the court reduced it to the limit to $2.7 million. And the jury sobbed when I told them their award and all their work, what they thought was justice for them, was essentially taken out of their hands by our laws. And so we do have caps on these things. We do have limits, and they're rational, reasonable limits. And we need doctors to understand that we have their back. This notion that there is this battle, and this tension here is, I think, based on the fact that we're just not communicating well.
Well, and one of the things that I've said, I used to tell this to managers at the city when they got into kind of a push and pull, is let's put everybody in a room.
Yeah.
The trial attorneys, legislators, the doctors, and figure it out.
I'm hoping we'll all get in a room with Dr. Birx, that I'll get to have lunch with you guys and Dr. Birxen and maybe a couple others and talk about this. But we have a caller. Good morning.
Yeah, hey, it's
almost
me.
We're almost at the end. So
I know, this will be real quick. This is Walt. I just heard Senator Cervantes talk about the fact that he himself does malpractice case. I have to ask about the question of conflict of interest. I mean, how is the fact that any bill on this has to get through Senate and House Judiciary committees that are filled with attorneys, and the person heading the Senate committee is himself a malpractice attorney. How is that not a conflict of interest? And I will shut up and listen.
Should you recuse yourself from debating this issue or voting on it?
Well, that's the point that I made earlier, which is, again, I'm credited or blamed, depending on your perspective, for being the obstacle to all this. And I will tell you, I had absolutely nothing to do with the negotiations in 2021. It was headed by the governor. The doctors were represented by the medical society. The hospital was represented by the hospital association. They were in the negotiations. The trialers were represented by different people. But I was not involved at all, and I have never been involved in drafting or writing any legislation or stopping any legislation as in my capacity as a senator. It's never happened.
So my question is, should you even be able to vote on it?
Well,
I appreciate that you're not leading the effort, but why do you not have a conflict of interest is my question.
Well, and I very well may be, as we look at specific legislation. This is a challenge we have in New Mexico because, for example, we have teachers in the legislature who vote on education salaries, right? We have their budgets and education policy. This is the nature of our legislature, which is we have people everybody has a conflict of interest, arguably, with the budget, right? When I pass, my wife used to teach at the university. When I voted for the budget of NMSU, indirectly, I'm supporting her salary. You could take this to infinite levels, right? My daughter, as I said, is coming back. My son-in-law's doctors. If I pass any of these laws one way or the other, I'm implicating them. And I can just tell you, that's the best challenge to a conflict of interest is the dinner table. If I'm passing laws that are hurting doctors, I've got to look my daughter and son-in-law at the eye across the Thanksgiving table and justify it. And I got to tell you, they didn't want to come back because they've heard all these terrible things. Mm-hmm. I spent 30 minutes with them, and they were happy to be coming back.
Well, good. We'll
I will shut up. I will just say that if that's our best, then it's not good enough, and I will shut up.
You mean as far as the conflict of interest?
Yeah, I mean, yes, there are, if you stretch it out, there are potentially conflicts of everything, but this is direct. This is, this isn't something where you have to go two or three stages of Kevin Bacon. This is... this is attorneys voting to protect attorneys.
Yeah, his point for listeners is, Joe Cervantes does medical malpractice cases and asks sometimes for punitive damages, and the issue is, should the state limit the amount that he could get for his client? He gets a percentage of it. Should Joe recuse himself and not vote on that issue?
Again, we'll have to look at the legislation and see. That may very well be. And it has happened before. I've certainly not voted on certain laws that I think do directly implicate my practice of law. I will tell you the notion that there's a bunch of lawyers in the legislature is, a misrepresentation of the reality. There are no lawyers on the Republican caucus any longer in the Senate, and that's terrible. We've lost all the lawyers on the Republican side, and we missed them. They were important, and they led the negotiation that led to the medical malpractice bill last time around was one of the Republican lawyers.
We have run over a little bit. We've been talking with Kathy Stark and Joe Cervantes about medical malpractice and the doctor shortage. Thank you both for being here. Thanks to callers as well. We'll be back in about 1 minute.